Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
And hi, everybody. Welcome to Behind the Curtain. This is Paul Lisnick with another exciting podcast, a very interesting show this week, and in fact, a very prominent guest from the state of and the history of the state of Illinois. Joining me today is former Governor George Ryan, who has a new book out called Until I Could Be Sure, How I Stopped the Death Penalty in Illinois. Governor, I know a lot of people expected your book to be all about the time you had to spend in prison, which took away time from your life. We're going to talk about it, but it wasn't the reason you wrote this book. What was the real purpose for wanting to create this history of your experience with dealing with the death penalty?
Well, it's kind of a long story, Paul, of how we got started with this. I just kind of fell into it, basically. I was always a strong advocate of the death penalty during my whole life, and even when I went to the General Assembly back in 1972. That was the year the United States Supreme Court abolished the death penalty all across the land. And that was in 72, and in 77, the Supreme Court came back and said it's time to reinstate the death penalty, but you'll have to meet our standards to whatever we had. And so each state had to propose their own death penalty rules and laws and have it to be found constitutional by the federal government. And so that's what we did in 1977. What did I say, 72? Well, 77, that we reinstated the death penalty. And we had a great, vigorous debate on the House floor. I was a member of the House then. And Bob Mann, you may remember Bob Mann. He,
yep.
He was a pretty liberal guy. He was a Democrat on the Democrat side. And as we voted that day, I pushed my green button and voted yes to reinstate the death penalty. And Bob Mann got up during the debate and said, for those of you that are voting green, how many of you would be willing to throw the switch and kill somebody? Now, that gave me a little pause for thought. I thought about it and said, well, I think the death penalty is important and we ought to have it. And it's needed to prevent crime in those days. I believe that. And I continued to vote green, but said I wouldn't really want to have anything to do with throwing the switch and killing somebody. And lo and behold, some 20 years later, that's exactly the position I was in. I was the fellow that was the last vestige for anybody that was to die on death row and be executed. So that was my initiation with the death penalty. And as we went through the years and the time, Anthony Porter case came up. You may remember that case. It was
yes.
It was a little black guy from the south side of Chicago that got convicted and sent to death row for the murder of a young couple on the south side at a ballpark, or a swimming pool, I guess it was, been convicted of murdering somebody in a bad drug deal. And I was watching the news right after I got elected governor. I was only governor for a couple, 3 months, I think, when that happened, that he was let out of jail. And I was sitting watching the television with my wife in Springfield at the mansion. And here comes Anthony Porter out with a big grin on his face. And the reporter says, here's Anthony Porter, just been found that he was innocent of the crime he was convicted of. And the courts have released him, and he's been released today. And Anthony Porter spent 16 years on death row, wondering every morning when he woke up whether it was the day he was going to be executed or not. For 16 years that happened to him. And I turned to my wife and said, I don't know how that happens in America. How do you keep somebody on death row for 16 years, ruin their life, and destroy whatever they may have going for them, and then tell them, oops, we made a mistake? And in addition, just to add insult to injury, of course, the officials that pay out for those kind of cases that they pay out for, they give them some money, didn't want to even pay the guy for his 16 years in prison. I think they gave him a measly sum. And but he was didn't really understand everything that was going on around him. And so I just kind of watched that case for a while. And then, lo and behold, David Protest from Northwestern University has a class on journalism. And these journalism students were assigned the Anthony Porter case to see how he got tied up in that situation. They hired a prosecutor to help him investigate. As you well know, the rest is history. They found the real killer up in Wisconsin someplace, a fellow by the name of Al Story Simon, who signed a confession. The group also hired an investigator to help him investigate the case, and he got a taped confession out of Al Story Simon that he did the murder. It was not Anthony Porter. So that kind of set the stage for how I got involved and really got into the death penalty. We almost executed an innocent person, and I'm not sure that whether we ever have or not, but I know we've come awful close many times in the state of Illinois.
Well, and as you said, Governor, when you were in the legislature, maybe it's easy enough, depending on your point of view, to say, sure, green light it. This is fine to proceed. You write a lot. I have to tell, people should really read this book because it's really full of individual stories. I mean, you have a great memory for the folks that you had to deal with. And you write a lot early on in the book about a serial murderer and rapist whose name was Andrew Kokorelis. And for me, that in the book seemed to be a turning point for you, because you write a lot about the fact that you were up in the residence with Laura Lynn, with your wife, and actually even Kokorelis himself thought you were going to stop his execution, but you let him die. Has that moment lingered with you in that decision?
Every day.
And so do you have any regrets? I'm guessing you're saying you have regrets about what happened then.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes, I do have regrets for Paul, or I did have at the time. You know, it's kind of worn off some now, but at that time, there was, and Eddie Kokorelis was really a bad guy. He did some terrible things and was convicted of it. But we're coming off of the Anthony Porter case where he'd been 16 years in prison. You know, I said to myself, what if Kokorelis is innocent? Well, everybody said that he was guilty, and they went through the procedures. Well, Anthony Porter did the same things, and they were getting ready to kill him. So I had some thoughts about is Andrew Kokorelis. Not only did I have the bad thoughts, but I had a whole group of people that were for me not executing him, not to sign his execution papers. And they made Anthony Porter and Andrew Kokorelis, I guess, got the idea that maybe I was going to pardon him. And I wasn't sure whether I was or not. I wasn't going to pardon him, but I wasn't going to let him be executed. And I had the church people, the archdiocese of the Greek church came through, and they was after me almost every day, along with lots of other people, not to execute him. They were anti-death penalty people. And so that gave me a lot of pause for thought, and I finally decided that I would sign an execution and kill him. But that's what I did, and I had to live with it. Of course, I had to live with it the rest of my life.
And the book is filled with these death-qualified crimes. Some were horrendous. The one that really got to me, I think I actually remember this, was it was your neighbor. It was Stephen Small. He was kidnapped. He was buried alive, and he suffocated to death. And this was somebody you knew. He was a neighbor of yours. And then yet, after that, you signed the moratorium on January 31st, 2000. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is the book sort of shows this conflict that you experienced, and it's almost as though you're getting tested every step of the way, even when it comes as close as the house next door, Stephen Small.
Well, of course, when I started on the death penalty thing, and then we got into it with my staff, and I was talking about not having any more executions and calling a moratorium and eventually commuting the sentences, I didn't have anybody. I had one person on my staff, and that was Matthew Bettenhausen, who was my lead man on the death penalty program. That's who he worked with me the most. He was the only one that said I was probably doing the right thing. Everybody else on my staff was absolutely opposed to what was going on. So I had to put up with my staff, fighting with those guys every day and those people. They were all good folks who had good intentions. But there wasn't anybody really saying, boy, yeah, right, go ahead and do it. Let's get it done. They were all against it.
Yeah, in 2003, you then commuted more than 160 death sentences to life sentences. And I know you appeared on my television show, Political Report, and you said you reviewed every case. You took those files with you on planes and in cars and looking at every one. Was there anybody in that group of commutations that you looked and said, you know, this guy, this one maybe deserves to be put to death? Or did you see these horrendous crimes but say, no, you come to realize nobody deserved to be put to death?
Well, I said there were so many. The other part of the problem with the death penalty, Paul, is that it's just fraught with error. Every place you look at it, there's a possibility for error, and in a lot of cases. And the Tribune even did a series that even brought more attention to me to commute the sentences and to call the moratorium. I mean, the prosecutorial misconduct, you got overeager prosecutors that want to make a name for themselves, and you know, they kind of make up stories, some of them. I understand. These people aren't all bad, but some are, and they want them. I think the director of the FBI recently, or the director of the Justice Department, said some of them are headhunters. And you got the defense lawyers that came in drunk, used drugs, and didn't know what was going on, provided lousy defense for somebody that's fighting for their life. In a courtroom, I got an attorney that doesn't know what's going on. We had all-white juries elected as convicting and sentencing to death black inmates. There was just nothing fair about the whole situation that I looked at, and that's part of the reason that I thought about it, too, and did it, really.
I know, I mean, capital punishment, Governor, invokes the most intensive emotions in people, right? And is it really a process of trying to put rational thinking above the emotional? Because, I mean, you also had to deal with the families of victims, people whose family suffered the loss of somebody through murder, and you're the guy who's not letting the state put that person to death. Did you see this as a rational process versus emotional?
Well, it's a little bit of everything, you know. I met with both sides, both the prosecutor, the prisoners' families, and the victims' families at different times, of course. And it was very tough to meet with them, especially the families of the victims who just couldn't understand why, you know, that we couldn't execute people, or why I was even thinking about not executing the people that violated their families. The other side of the coin was the families of the convicted. You know, they didn't have anything to do with it, and here you got, you know, grandchildren, and just like the other side, only it was just to take another life. And then, of course, the big reason, one of the big reasons, is that we had and during the course of all of this, more people exonerated from death row than were executed. And they were exonerated by the courts. Or they found errors in the cases and found out there were mistakes made, and retried some people that didn't get the death penalty, and some that were even just did not released from even the crime they thought they were guilty of. So there was just a lot of place for error. And if you're going to have a penalty for a crime that takes somebody's life, you better have a system that works perfectly. And I don't know of any system that works perfectly, and especially the death penalties, are just because every place along the line, there's some kind of a place for have a mistake made by the prosecution or by the defense, either on purpose or unintentionally. And do we want to take a chance on executing an innocent person? And that was basically my concern. And during my course of day there, we came pretty close to executing some innocent people. Not me, but the system over the years.
You, when you then ultimately signed the moratorium, which truly paved the way for the end of the death penalty, you said that was not courageous at all. And I think at some point around that time, you met Nelson Mandela. I mean, you kind of became this international hero to a lot of anti-death penalty people. But your comment was, this was not courageous at all on your part, that courage was Mandela and police officers and those who are wrongly convicted, who are minutes away from their execution. Once again, a very profound effect on you.
Well, it really was a no-brainer. You know, I kind of likened that whole situation, Paul, to flying an airplane from Chicago to Boston, and it crashes 3 days a week. I don't know whether the airlines, I can't believe they wouldn't stop flying the airplane. So we had the people that were found guilty and were in line to be executed, then found out before they were executed that they were really innocent and didn't commit the crime at all. So what do you do? Do you still continue to fly the airplane, or do you stop it and say, let's see what's wrong, see if we can fix it? And that's what I tried to do, was fix it, and that's when I appointed a Blue Star Ribbon committee to study the whole situation and let me know what we could do to improve, if that's the right word, the death penalty. An improvement would be to lessen the chance that an innocent person would be executed. And the committee came up with 18, I think, different, 85, it was 85 suggestions that we used to change the laws to make sure it was safer. And, of course, it was an election year. And, you know, when you run for office, I guess people don't want to be, that are candidates, don't want to be considered soft on crime. You may recall when Jim Edgar ran against Dawn Clark Netsch, he painted her as soft on crime. And, I mean, he beat her pretty bad based just on that issue. So we made the recommendations to the General Assembly, and they failed to pass all but or to none on none of the recommendations except one, and that was the videotaping of confessions, especially in capital cases or capital murder cases and things like that.
In the book's epilogue, you finally get to your conviction. You know that's what people wanted to get your thoughts on, for federal corruption. It's very clear to me, although you did, you know, years in federal prison, and I know how difficult that was, believe me. But that being said, you to this day, I think, feel wrongly convicted. It was, you never accepted the conviction in that case. You're entitled to feel that way. What is wrong with the criminal justice system when it puts people who don't see themselves as being responsible for something that's happened? What's wrong with the system, and how do you fix it?
Well, I guess if we could really fix it, we'd probably. I don't think it can be fixed, frankly. I thought that for a while when I first started on this thing, because I was a firm believer in the death penalty. But the more I got into it and saw how it was, you know, we had police captain Burge that was convicting everybody and that was innocent and torturing them to get the signed confessions. I don't know how you stop that or how you fix it. You just have to be vigilant, I guess. And then if you're not vigilant enough, then it happens. So I don't think you can fix it. I just think that it's impossible to fix. And if you're going to kill somebody, you better make sure it's perfect. The system will never be perfect.
For the time that you spent in prison, I mean, you were fortunate enough to be given some time to visit with your wife when she was dying. And look, a lot of people, I don't know what kind of news you saw in prison, but there were some people that thought you were given special treatment when you got to go visit with her. That being said, when she did pass, you did not go to her funeral. You missed your brother's funeral. Are you at peace with all that transpired during those years?
No. Well, I don't know. What do you mean? I mean, at peace that I missed my wife's funeral and missed my brother's funeral?
Accepting that this is the way things have gone. Are you simply sort of, this is the way life has gone?
Well, you know, it's things that happen, but compared to, you know, I just think that in my case, I'm not the only guy that went through that. They ought to have some different rules with the Department of Justice, I guess, for people that go through that. I mean, it could take 2 or 3 days to let a fellow go home and see his wife buried. You know, in my case, or in any case, it's not a violent criminal. You ought to be able to do that. Life's pretty short, and to live with somebody for 50 or 60 years, like I did, and was married, and then told that I couldn't go to her funeral. There wouldn't have been anything wrong with me coming home for a couple of days and then going back. But they want to show how tough they are.
Did you, the relationships you had, your wife, your kids, all of that, I'm assuming everybody, they stood behind you, they understood, and it was probably as tough for them in many ways as it was tough for you. Sort of curious whether you, did you have a tough time in prison, or did people, hey, you're a former governor, were they especially nice to you?
No, I didn't have a tough time at all. I mean, everybody was in, I was in a camp, Paul, where I had a couple of cards there, and there was, I mean, it wasn't like being what you see in the movies or anything. It was easy to do. So, it was unpleasant, but I made it. So, you know, life goes on.
So, Governor, while I have you, just a couple of current state of affairs things. You probably have noticed the state is in a financial mess. And I'm sort of curious, number one, do you have any thoughts about how Governor Pritzker's doing? Do you support the, you know, this progressive income tax? Are we on the right road here? And if not, what would you do?
Well, you know, Pritzker's in a tough situation. I mean, the state is broke and he's got to raise money. And the only place you can raise money when you're the governor is raise taxes. And that's what he, I guess, has to do. So he's got a tough road to hoe. I don't know whether his bill will pass or not, but everybody's going to take a good look at it, I'm sure.
So you're a lifelong Republican, and obviously when it came to this whole issue of the death penalty, you probably had more Democrats in love with you than Republicans moving on. But I'm sort of curious, as you watch these years of Trump, again, you're a public figure, so I think it's fair to ask you, are you going to vote for Trump? Are you in Trump's camp for this next election?
Now, why would I tell you who I'm going to vote for, Paul?
Well, I'm asking. You don't have to.
You have 100,000 other people that are listening.
Well, let me ask you. Well, what is your view of the current state of the national situation? Then I'll put it that way, without asking you to reveal your vote.
Well, I think Trump has done a fairly decent job with most everything he's been involved in. Certainly, everything he campaigned on, he said he was going to do, he's done, and built a great record with his economic programs. Whether he can bring it back or not, I don't know. But and Joe Biden is a guy that spent 30 or 40, 50 years in the Senate or in the federal government someplace. So he's certainly got enough experience to do whatever it is he does. So I guess we're going to have to wait and see what happens on November 3rd.
That was a very good answer, because at first I thought, oh, you're sounding like you're in Trump's camp. And then you said nice stuff about Biden. So are you undecided? Let me put it that way. Are you, or do you know what you're going to do?
I know what I'm going to do. Sure.
Okay. All right. I'll call you privately.
How about you, Paul? How are you going to vote?
Yeah. Well, I'm a journalist. I'm not allowed to say how I'm going to vote. That's the difference.
Yeah,
you're a politician.
You're allowed to
vote. Get to. And I did. I already voted. I sent it in by mail. By the way, do you have any concerns about vote in mail? Or you think it's all safe?
No, I think it's crazy. I think what the bail out millions of ballots. I mean, who knows where they go and who gets them? And no, I think they should not do that. I vote absentee mostly because when I was in office and campaigning and out on the roads doing what I did, I was never really home long enough to get in there. So I always voted absentee.
Well, of course, in our state,
absentee voting was safe. I mean, the county clerk, you go in and they give you a ballot, or they send you one and you send it back, or else you can go in early and vote early.
So. Yeah, well, in Illinois, you know, absentee and mail-in are basically the same thing. There are states that just mail them out, but in Illinois, you have to request it. So I think we're safe in this state.
Yeah.
Well, Governor George Ryan, thanks for your time. The book is called Until I Could Be Sure, How I Stopped the Death Penalty in Illinois. I hope this next chapter of your life, Governor, you get out there, give speeches, and you know, I know that's what this book is about. Let people know the process you went through, because it may put them through a similar process. And I thank you for sharing your views on this and for talking about your own personal situations as well.
Paul, let me put a little plug in here. My book is available at the Abraham Lincoln Bookshop at the 800 block of West Superior Avenue in the city of Chicago, and it's available, I think, now. I don't know. I think they got some books there to sell.
And that's it. By the way, I've been to that bookstore. Daniel, who runs it, great guy and great place. And will they be signed? Are you going to do any? I know we're in a virtual world, but will you be signing any books?
Yeah, we're going to try and work something out. You know, the virus dictates everything most of us do these days, and we're trying to figure out a good way to work something out to do that. And I probably will have some signings in a couple of weeks or less.
I hope so. The book is Until I Could Be Sure by Governor George H. Ryan, Sr., former governor of the state of Illinois. Governor, appreciate your time very much.
Thanks, Paul, for your call. I appreciate it.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's P-A-U-L-L-I-S-N-E-K. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.
During these uncertain times, you want to feel confident in your family's well-being. DuPage Medical Group continues to provide dedicated care throughout Chicagoland. While using additional safety measures and patient pre-screening, it's the same convenient access with a new level of reassurance so that you can keep your close connection with the physicians who know you so well. Learn more today at ScheduleDMG.com. DuPage Medical Group. We care for you.